Lena Dunham, you'll remember, went on The View in full schoolmarmish mode to remind the feminist sisterhood of its duty to re-educate those poor, ungrateful, ill-educated female hillbillies who voted Republican. Those weren't her exact words, but we understood what she was getting at. Is there anything more revealing than leftists shutting out the voices of women and minorities because they're telling them things they don't want to hear? And this is the true story of Gamergate and why it matters so much, not the misogynist white dude's narrative you've heard from the mainstream media. This was the first time that identity politics in America was genuinely threatened. It was about issues that would become dividing lines in the emerging millennial culture wars, as well as in the 2016 general election. Free speech, the future of the open internet, and a nightmarishly partisan press corps that demonized critics of fashionable progressive causes as hate-filled bigots, while holding up their own spokespeople as saints who could do no wrong, often, and sometimes especially, when those spokespeople had dark histories. In the 2000s, Jack Thompson, a conservative lawyer, filed a lawsuit against Take-Two Interactive, the publishers of the Grand Theft Auto series, on the grounds that the video game inspired murder. He was mercilessly ridiculed by the games press, which then appeared to be performing its essential function as the defender of creative freedom against absurd political crusades. Because of battles like this with the conservative right in the 90s and perhaps in the early 2000s, gamers developed a resistance to politicization of any kind. "I just wanted to play video games" was one of the slogans of Gamergate. Gamers took pride in their hobby's resistance in the face of an increasingly politicized world, and this is how video games managed to escape the first wave of the left's cultural takeover. Researchers can find no evidence that games make anyone violent, but they can also find no evidence that games make anyone sexist. The studies that leftists and moral crusaders frequently cite are those that show a link between violent video games and aggression, but similar links are also found in sports. You play a high-adrenaline sport and you become more aggressive. It's not a mystery. But it's nowhere near the same as saying that video games turn people into killers or turn people into sexists. A lack of evidence never gets in the way of a good storyline, and you may remember Elliot Rodgers, the killer virgin who went on a shooting rampage in May 2014. Naturally, the fact that he played video games was invoked by the press. No evidence that games had anything to do with his actions was ever presented, but no evidence was needed. The storyline that video games must be involved in bad behavior was simply too compelling to pass up for the media. The same thing happened to one of my old heroes, Marilyn Manson, who was blamed for the Columbine school shootings even though the shooters themselves hated him and didn't listen to his music. One report simply decided Manson was to blame, and the rest of the media followed suit. When feminist critics began taking tentative steps into the sphere of games criticism, the new allegation was that even though games can't make you violent, they can turn you into a woman hater. These were not psychologists or researchers who had data to back up their claims. They were gender activists and hipsters with degrees in cultural studies, according to feminist scholar Christina Hoff Summers. They didn't know much about video games, but they sure knew cis-heteropatriarchal capitalist oppression when they saw it. What I call the left-wing war on fun has a long academic pedigree, stretching to the rise of critical studies in the late 60s and 70s. Critical studies viewed art, literature, and entertainment through only one lens: how it critiqued or failed to critique dominant power structures, such as capitalism, Christianity, patriarchy, and all that malarkey. No longer were these forms to be criticized on their ability to inspire, to awe, to shock, to fascinate, to illustrate, or simply to depict. All that mattered was how well or how poorly they critiqued the boogeymen of gender studies departments. Like overzealous Freudian psychologists who managed to link virtually every human experience back to childhood sexual trauma, progressive cultural critics find a way to interpret every artistic expression through their own particular lens of victimhood. Lisa Ruddick, an English professor at the University of Chicago, an institution in the running for the smartest and most forward-looking university of modern times, is one of a growing number of dissidents challenging this orthodoxy. In her influential essay, When Nothing Is Cool, she describes how one scholar used critical studies to turn Buffalo Bill, the sadistic antagonist of Silence of the Lambs, into a gender-defying feminist hero. By removing and wearing women's skin, Bill apparently refutes the idea that maleness and femaleness are carried within us. Gender, Judith Halberstam explains, is, quote, always post-human, always a sewing job which stitches identity into a body bag. The corpse, once flayed, has been degendered. It is post-gender, end quote. Halberstam blends her perspective uncritically with the hero-villain's post-human sensibility, which she sees as registering a historical shift in an era marked by the destruction of gender binaries and of the boundary between inside and outside. The lunacy here isn't that this is just a serial killer who targets only women, and that there's no way that this guy could be a feminist hero. It's that the scholar who wrote it actually thought her interpretation was plausible. To most people, Silence of the Lambs is just a masterful psychological thriller, full of compelling characters, emotionally powerful moments, with no great deeper meaning beyond the protagonist's terrifying and engrossing journey through the world of cannibals, serial killers, and crossdressers. But to a left-wing culture critic like Halberstam, it's unacceptable that a movie could simply be intended to entertain, shock, or amuse. It must say something deeper, even if its creator didn't intend it to. And if a piece of art or entertainment really seems designed with no hidden political message, well, that's just because its creator and those who enjoy it must be fine with the status quo, and that makes them either blind or the enemy. To a culture critic, everything is political, even when it's not trying to be. The Los Angeles Times interviewed Jordan Peele, the creator of Get Out, one of the few politically motivated movies that still manages to entertain, and asked him about the significance of one of the white actresses in his film, Drinking Milk. Milk, the Los Angeles Times later offered, was, quote, the new symbol of white supremacy in America, owing to its hue and the notion that lactose intolerance in certain ethnicities means that milk-absorbing Caucasian genetics are superior, end quote. Well, Get Out isn't about that. It's about a white family that kidnaps black people so they can brain swap with their younger, cooler, and physically superior bodies. The theme could not possibly be more racially motivated, but the Los Angeles Times felt the need to find racism wherever it looked. Peele did not back up this milk-drinking as racism thesis in any way, and yet the Los Angeles Times' headline still read, Jordan Peele explains Get Out's creepy milk scene and ponders the recent link between dairy and hate. Little wonder that culture warriors hate video games, many of which are clearly designed for no purpose than wild abandon. Imagine the fury of Anita Sarkeesian and her dour erstwhile male assistant Jonathan McIntosh as they scoured games like Team Fortress 2 and Pong for hidden messages. Imagine it dawning on them that the millions of people who log into World of Warcraft every day might be doing so just to have fun with their friends, not to consider how well Illidan Stormrage symbolizes inexorable patriarchal hegemony. To a leftist, where everything is political and nothing is fun, gamers are a nightmare. Well, gamers feel the same about their critics, because gaming culture is naturally resistant to political correctness. Online video games were the original social networks. Gamers were chatting on games like EverQuest and RuneScape years before Facebook and Twitter came into their own. And crucially, communication in these games tended to be anonymous. Like 4chan and Reddit, the furthest most people would come to identifying another player was via their pseudonym, and there's not much you can do to track someone when the only thing you have is a username. Anonymity, mixed with the competitive nature of many online games, led to a culture of trash talk among gamers. Keemstar, a popular YouTuber, explains how alien and shocking gamer culture must seem to polite society. He says, quote, I've received many death threats. I've been told that I'm going to be raped. People have said they were going to do sexual things to me while I was playing these games. This is part of gaming culture. I'm not saying it's right, but any real gamer has experienced this, and they know it to be somewhat normal. This is what people say online to each other when they're gaming, end quote. If you're not familiar with gaming culture, the whole idea that this kind of talk is normal must seem very strange, but this is merely the kind of joshing that goes on between best friends, especially in young male communities. Nobody feels threatened because everyone knows the rules of the game. For instance, hey, filthy fucking dick waffle might be used as a friendly greeting. Some of the most common topics for casual jokes in game culture include rape, necrophilia, and Nazism. If someone thinks you're behaving stupidly or disagrees with you, go kill yourself is a common, almost automatic offhand remark. The biggest mistake you can make is to take any of this language at face value. Now, yes, it might be jarring for someone who's not used to the conventions of this speech community, but that is no excuse for condemning it as bigoted or misogynist when you know that it isn't. And if you don't like it, online games afford multiple opportunities to set up your own gaming servers with your own rules. Mainstream society finds it impossible to reconcile this language with the reality that most gamers are actually left-wing, not to mention completely comfortable with diverse, tolerant societies. To leftists, rejecting their language codes is the same as being racist, sexist, or homophobic, but gamers know that's not so. And it made them the perfect enemies for an increasingly progressive movement hell-bent on shaming ordinary people for violations of dreary, stultifying language codes. In the years preceding Gamergate, left-wing social justice warriors had turned social media into their own personal playground. With the aid of outlets like BuzzFeed, Gawker, and The Guardian, they engaged in relentless public shaming campaigns to socially ostracize individuals, businesses, and organizations that failed to abide by their increasingly restrictive set of politically correct norms. Justine Sacco, a communications executive whose life was ruined by Gawker after she tweeted a fairly crap joke about white people not being able to catch AIDS, is a well-known example. Ironically, Sacco's tweet was an attempt to make a point about the injustices of white privilege, and for that crime, she became the most hated woman in America and lost her job, at least for 24 hours she was. The point of public shaming, you see, isn't merely to offend or annoy, but to cause total social ostracism. It's the ultimate punishment for violating society's taboos. Video games didn't escape the rise of public shaming. In May 2014, a small-time video games developer, Russ Rogner, discovered that his career was in jeopardy. "Be careful with me," warned Gamasutra's Lee Alexander. "I am a megaphone," she said. "I wouldn't mind making an example out of you." This has been an amazing look at someone just starting out, burning every bridge possible, remarked games journalist Ben Kuchera. And Ian Miles Chong, editor-in-chief of Gamerank, said, "Really, just stop. You're not helping your case." What had Rogner said to attract such warnings? Simply this: there's no issue with gender equality in the game industry. I wish people would stop saying there is. Expressing such a view, merely an opinion, right or wrong, was career-endangering in the video game industry of 2014. Another infamous case of media-led public shaming in the gaming industry was the campaign against Brad Wardell, CEO of software and games development company Stardock. In 2010, Wardell was falsely accused of sexual harassment by a former employee. Ben Kuchera wrote an article initially claiming that the case against Wardell had damning evidence and included some of the most disgusting accusations from Wardell's accuser, including the claim that he had asked her if she, quote, "enjoyed tasting semen," end quote. Wardell was not contacted for comment before the article ran. Kotaku ran the same story, covering the accuser's allegations in similarly lurid detail. The article contained the full allegations of Wardell's accuser, but no counter-arguments from Wardell or his legal representation. This was because Kotaku had only given Wardell an hour to respond with his side of the story. As a result of this sloppy Rolling Stone-tier journalism, Wardell faced years of smears and attacks, and even told me later that his kids were being shamed at school because the first Google result for his name was the Kotaku article. It's worth noting that Wardell is one of the few open political conservatives with a position of prominence in the gaming industry, which might explain why the campaign against him was so relentless. The case was dismissed in 2013, and the former employee apologized for her claims. Game Politics, one of the outlets that's reported on the unsubstantiated allegations against him, apologized for its sloppy reporting. And others followed suit, but it was too little, too late. There's no way to unstab someone once your pitchfork has pierced their flesh. Public shaming relies on isolating victims who are made to believe that they are alone against an overwhelming tide of majority opinion. It's a feeling that was shared by many Donald Trump supporters, until we started winning. In reality, the shamers are usually part of a vocal minority, allowed to dominate the conversation by terrifying others into silence. But gamers are hard to frighten. During Gamergate, they came out in droves to show the world how small and hysterical the purveyors of social ostracism actually were. Kotaku in Action, the leading Reddit community for Gamergate supporters, has more than 70,000 subscribers. GamerGazi, the hub for feminists and social justice warriors in gaming, has recently reached a mere 11,000. Gawker, one of the worst public shaming organizations ever to exist, was even kowtowed by Gamergate. Editor Sam Biddle, who had been personally responsible for destroying Justine Sacco's life, was forced to apologize for anti-Gamergate tweets he said were jokes. It was a rare apology from one of the most unscrupulous sites on the internet. Soon, Gawker's disgusting lack of journalistic integrity would kill the site. But if it weren't for Gamergate, Gawker would still be here. Through numbers and tenacity, gamers broke through their fear of social justice warriors. The months following the birth of Gamergate saw a full-scale backlash against social justice warriors. Sites like Kotaku and Polygon, bastions of social justice, created new disclosure policies in response to Gamergate's demands. This stuff matters because before Gamergate, victims of public shaming like Justine Sacco had virtually no allies in the press. Many disagreed, but they didn't want to get on the wrong side of the social justice mobs. After Gamergate, victims like Dr. Matt Taylor, the British astrophysicist who was driven to tears after he was attacked for wearing a shirt featuring allegedly sexualized drawings of sci-fi women, could rely on an increasingly confident community of moderate liberals and conservatives who loudly and sternly condemned the persecutors. The silence had been broken, and we had gamers to thank for it. Gamergate was hugely culturally significant, but almost entirely missed by conservative media. It was the first time consumers of a major entertainment medium staged a mass resistance to the influence of the political left. Gamers showed frightened, isolated dissidents that it was possible to fight the cultural left and to win. No one was more amazed than I was. I once described gamers as dorky weirdos in yellowing underpants, and some of them probably are. Perfectly nice people, I'm sure. But here were those dorky weirdos taking on the fury of the left-wing media activist complex without flinching. Unpaid, undisciplined, and yes, in some cases unhygienic, but they were winning cultural victories that had eluded even million-dollar conservative PACs. After Gamergate, never again can gamers be mocked as awkward losers. They might be awkward, but they're not losers. In a Breitbart column on the movement's one-year anniversary, I compared them to hobbits, unlikely heroes who just wanted to be left alone but ended up saving the world. In retrospect, it's perhaps not so surprising that a bunch of people who spend all their spare time conquering kingdoms, killing dragons, and racking up high scores knew how to win. But it did seem remarkable at the time. The left didn't know what they were getting themselves into when they went after video games. This was the hobby of the millennial generation enjoyed by millions around the world, often together. What chance did the left really have with their usual allegations of bigotry against such a naturally diverse hobby? The sight of the left attacking innocent gamers as a menacing force of intolerance was laughable. Perhaps the fears of the left weren't so hysterical, though, because gamers were the first group of people to beat them in the millennial culture wars. Their tactics helped to inspire a new movement of cultural libertarians, setting off a chain of events that eventually put Donald Trump in the White House. When the Washington Post called Donald Trump the Gamergate of American politics, intending it as an insult, they were not wrong. And while most of the hard work was conducted by tireless, relentless, and often anonymous gamers who received no thanks beyond smears from the mainstream media, I am enormously proud of playing a part in the movement as well. Gamers taught me that with humor, memes, and a little bit of autistic single-mindedness, no battle is unwinnable. Chapter 11. Why my college tours are so awesome. I was in the middle of a speech at Rutgers University in New Jersey when three hysterical young ladies in the audience stood up and smeared what looked like blood on their faces, hysterically shrieking Black Lives Matter over and over. None of these students, incidentally, were black, and I later discovered that the blood was fake, but that didn't make it any less absurd, or any less troublesome, of course, for the janitors who had to deal with the trail of red paint left by these spoilt brat middle-class protesters after their 2 minutes of fame were up. Peaceful attendees who'd come to hear a speech instead found themselves splashed with fake blood, while at least one attendee was assaulted by a protester who deliberately smeared him with the stuff. More surprising to me than the protests at Rutgers, par for the course on college campuses, was what happened the following morning. Students at Rutgers were so traumatized by my presence that the administration held a group therapy session. Those who attended the therapy reported that students described feeling scared, hurt, and discriminated against because of my innocent lecture about the importance of free speech on campuses. If a few comments from me about the free and open exchange of ideas are enough to put college students into therapy, what's going to happen when they encounter someone who's actually intolerant and bigoted? When my tour started, I'd been in the spotlight for about a year as the rising star of the online right, fighting battles against the whiny, spoiled social justice warriors of the internet. Having grappled with some of their more absurd web-based campaigns, like the fight against online harassment, which, like hate speech, means anything they disagree with, I was now prepared to break out of tech journalism and take the fight to them in the real world. It sure was fun triggering them on the internet, but as I discovered during my protest of the 2015 Los Angeles slut walk, it was a lot more fun to hear their banshee-like shrieks of distress in real life. I knew my opponents were prone to emotional hysterics. I called my jaunt across college campuses the Dangerous Faggot Tour for that very reason, to mock students who seriously believed that a flouncing queen from across the pond posed some kind of threat to their safety. Soon after Rutgers, I arrived at Bucknell University, a small liberal arts college located in the sleepy rural town of Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. The chaos at my previous stop brought me to the attention of administrators there, who booted me from the on-campus guest residence over concerns that I presented a safety threat to the community, as if I might corrupt the basketball team or something. Some generous fraternity brothers took pity on me and eventually put me up in their house. By Thursday evening, Bucknell administrators had decided that students wouldn't be permitted to speak to me directly during my speech, but rather they'd have to write their questions down on index cards with my host, Tom Sakota, now a Breitbart reporter, reading them aloud to me. Furthermore, the Bucknell University Conservatives Club wouldn't be permitted to film the event. Instead, the administration would film the lecture and then release the footage to Tom if the proceedings didn't reflect poorly on the university. Shortly after I left Bucknell, Tom was removed from his position as class president. They said it was because he missed a few meetings, and who knows, maybe he had. But everyone on campus knew the real reason the rules were suddenly being applied so rigidly. Social justice leftists are running modern American universities, and they are so very, very petty. Did Bucknell's administrators really believe I was such a corrupting influence on young minds that I couldn't be allowed to speak to students directly? Did they really believe that I actually was, in fact, dangerous? No. At best, it was another pointless restriction designed to make conservatives on campus suffer, and at worst, it was outright censorship. Rutgers and Bucknell weren't outliers, unfortunately. As my tour progressed, it became apparent that lunacy was the norm, not the exception, on American college campuses. At the University of Pittsburgh, protesters were in the crowd, although they were less rowdy than the ones at Rutgers. But even their placards were quiet. They used tiny signs printed on inkjet printers. I had to have them read aloud to me because I couldn't see them. Really, Pittsburgh protesters, you were the pits. Afterward, their student government board held a meeting to discuss my appearance on campus. The student government president told college reporters that he teared up when he heard the stories of traumatized students. Another board member argued that my words constituted real violence and that left-wingers at the event felt they were in literal physical danger. Free speech should not trump safety, she said. These students truly believe that open discourse is a form of violence. The tour as a whole was anything but a disappointment. Videos of my talks, filmed on a shoestring, attracted millions of views on YouTube. Stories on Breitbart about the chaos and hysterics at my events received tens of thousands of comments and shares. I was exposing the angry, poorly dressed underbelly of American campus politics, and the world was rapt. By the time I reached Pittsburgh, it was only February 2016. I was not a month into the tour and had performed at fewer than six colleges. Yet it was already clear that I tapped into something massive. And so, after a brief series of meetings at Breitbart's Los Angeles offices and in Cannes during the film festival, I was told to go out, double down, and be more outrageous than ever. By then, word had spread to other colleges that there was a dangerous faggot on the loose. This caused protesters to up the ante, and at DePaul University in Chicago, I stood transfixed as Edward Ward, a Black Lives Matter activist, local minister, and alumnus, stormed the stage with a furious look in his eyes. Once I calmed my raging boner, I realized he'd grabbed the microphone from my student host and had essentially taken over the event. Meanwhile, a shrieking female accomplice had jumped on stage too and began dancing listlessly and swinging her fists an inch from my face. The police did nothing, something I later found out was a result of administrators ordering Chicago PD to stand down. I ended up cancelling my talk and leading my supporters outside for a protest march in defense of free speech. Despite grovelling to the left-wing protesters who wreaked havoc at the event, the university president, Dennis Holtschneider, tendered his resignation just 2 weeks later after pressure from left-wing students and faculty members who were angry that he hadn't banned me from campus altogether. Although the response of the university was pathetic, no one had been seriously hurt, and I was glad to see that my words were so vexing to the campus left. Rage was building. I find it difficult to understand how anyone could hate me, but such was the anger I confronted at every event that I came up with some theories, and all those theories boil down to one simple observation. I'm tremendous. I have single-handedly flummoxed the campus censors. In the years before my arrival, they'd been on a roll, stopping even mild-mannered conservative columnists like George Will from speaking on their campuses. Yet here I was, a magnificent blonde bastard who told edgy jokes and horror of horrors occasionally said celebrities were ugly. I was freely romping into their cherished safe spaces and there was nothing they could do to stop me. I had resources, I had the backing of Breitbart, the most fearless news organization in America, and I was riding a wave that I had helped to create. a new movement of young, politically dissident troublemakers. Just as I was attracting fanatical hatred, I was also attracting a devoted fan base. The shouts and shrieks of my protesters were loud, yes, but not as loud as the chants of Milo, Milo, and USA, USA from eager audiences. And at UC Santa Barbara, my fans even started the tradition of carrying me into lecture halls on a golden throne. It felt... well, it felt right. As my college tour progressed, it was clear that conservatives, libertarians, non-totalitarian liberals, and other political dissidents were becoming bolder and more mischievous on campus. The old order of political correctness was crumbling all around us, and we could all sense it. This, after all, was the glorious summer of Donald Trump's presidential campaign. At the University of Michigan, college crybabies went so far as to call the police after spotting pro-Trump chalk drawings on campus. Other students went further with their triggering pranks, constructing mock Trump walls on campus. If George Will were to arrive on a campus that summer, leftists would have been too busy protesting a dozen other outrages to even notice. Sometimes people don't understand just how loopy college campuses are, so let me tell you about one of the things campus crybabies get the most upset about. Cultural appropriation is the buzzword the left currently uses to torment people it accuses of disrespecting other cultures. White girls wearing dreadlocks or hoop earrings are a particularly popular target, as are Halloween parties where ponchos mean peril and you can be scalped for wearing a headdress. Wearing the garb or dancing the dances or even writing from the perspective of another culture is a grave act of neocolonial oppression. But compare that fantasy complaint with the reality of art. The Final Fantasy series borrows from George Lucas, who borrowed from Akira Kurosawa, who borrowed from Dostoevsky and Shakespeare. Without appropriation, culture as we know it could not exist. Civilization would resemble a Nickelback album. Cultural appropriation only applies, of course, to white people using or wearing or enjoying things created by non-white people. Black people can wear jeans, drink Guinness, eat spaghetti, and use electricity with no concern for the cultural ramifications of their actions. You know, if I didn't know better, I might conclude that cultural appropriation was just an excuse to paint white men as history's eternal villains. One particularly amusing example of cultural appropriation panic occurred in July 2015, when Boston's Museum of Fine Arts announced Kimono Wednesdays, in which visitors were encouraged to pose in kimonos next to Claude Monet's painting La Japonaise, which depicts the artist's wife in a similar outfit. Local leftists found the prospect of whiteys dressing up in oriental outfits outrageous and promptly conducted a sit-in at the museum. But hilariously, the mostly white college-age protesters soon found themselves joined by counter-protesters who were actually Japanese. According to the Boston Globe, the counter-protesters carried signs welcoming others to share in Japanese culture. Among the counter-protesters was Etsuko Yoshiro, a 53-year-old Japanese immigrant who helps to organize Boston's Japan Festival. Yoshiro told the Globe that she was disappointed by the other side and reportedly blamed the incident on the protesters' youth. Other local Japanese residents were similarly befuddled. The Deputy Consul General of Japan in Boston, Jiro Usui, told the Globe, "We actually do not quite understand what the point of their protest is." Well, you and me both, dude. Few things betray the short-sighted, joyless, anti-human stupidity of the left as much as cultural appropriation. Virtually every book, film, play, video game, and work of art is the result of a long history of cultural appropriation. It's how art functions. But to the campus left, it's just another form of racism. One of the reasons college students get so upset about everything is the poor quality of teaching they receive. Well-educated people are generally unshockable. Anyone who knows medieval history, medieval literature, or even just Shakespeare well is difficult to horrify. The reason progressive students and most of the media get so riled up about me is that they don't know anything. They have no intellectual hinterland and no curiosity about the world around them or about anything that has preceded their own lives. Centuries of history, culture, and wisdom are dismissed as the products of dead white men. The smuggest, supposedly smartest people in America are actually among the most hilariously stupid and poorly schooled. Like most power-mad cowards, leftists made desperate attempts to reassert control from the groups inviting me to their campuses. Their primary hope was that university administrations, which were often bursting with leftists themselves, would simply stop me from appearing. At UC Irvine, administrators allowed our event to proceed. I, a gay guy who loves black men, wore police fetish gear while scolding Black Lives Matter for not giving a shit about black lives. Nobody else in pop culture is making subversive statements like that anymore. Absolutely nobody. There are no pop stars, no authors who dare. After I left UC Irvine, the College Republicans group was slapped with a one-year ban by the university for having the temerity to invite me back. The justification for the ban was that the College Republicans had failed to provide a certificate of insurance for the security hired for my initial event. But given that the college administrators issued their ban just 1 hour after a meeting with College Republican President Ariana Rowlands, during which she revealed her intention to invite me back, the excuse was suspect from the start. After heavy coverage in Breitbart and the conservative media, as well as a terrific show of force by Rowlands herself, who refused to compromise with the administration, UC Irvine eventually engaged in a humiliating U-turn, lifting the suspension on the College Republicans and allowing me to return. As my tour gathered steam, the tactics used by frightened administrators to stop me became more underhand and slippery. At the University of Alabama, administrators hit my student hosts with a $7,000 security fee at the last minute. Again, after negative coverage in the conservative media and some stern lawyering, the university said the College Republicans would not face any expense for security, and that they had been trying all along to help them host a successful event. Other universities tried similarly slimy methods. The University of Miami cancelled over security concerns, which mysteriously arose just days before the event was scheduled to take place. The University of Maryland unwisely decided to copy the University of Alabama, slapping student organizers with a $6,500 security fee a few days before my event. But their defiance won't last. I am coming for them, and they know it. We will hold an event at the University of Maryland, come hell or high water, because they're a public institution, and they are prohibited by law from denying their students the right to hear differing opinions. The student hosts brave enough to invite me and earn the enmity of their administrations deserve heaps of praise. Despite these road bumps, by fall 2016, I could tell we were making a difference, because this was a movement, and it was going to take back American college campuses. It is taking back American college campuses, and it's already so much more fun than anything the enemy has to offer. Picture a tour bus, you know, like the ones that rock stars and rappers have, a beautiful, sleek, steel beast coated in black. Only the picture on the side isn't of a singer or a supermodel. It's a giant picture of my face staring directly at you besides bold text that reads, "Dangerous faggot." I don't think the word faggot has ever been printed so large before. By the time the second leg of my tour rolled around in September 2016, I was a superstar. So naturally, I got my own bus. I decided to call it Anita because I knew the bus would end up more famous than Gamergate antagonist Anita Sarkeesian. I was right. I used to think that I was so hot that nothing could make it easier for me to pick up dates. It turns out I was wrong. Having a tour bus with your face on it helps tremendously, and so does leaking a tour rider to the press that includes 24 dethorned white roses, 50 doves, 4 topless Abercrombie & Fitch models, a snow cone machine, and horse oil hand lotion. Anita the Fag Bus was soon spotted on dozens of college campuses, until she was eventually retired after being vandalized by Californian anarchists. After my early successes in triggering America's college crybabies, the invitations came pouring in, so we staged a 38-date tour of the entire country. We began in Texas, wound our way through Louisiana's coastline down into Florida, and then drove up through Georgia, Alabama, and the Carolinas, leaving a trail of furious college lefties and jubilant college conservatives in our wake. And this time, we were doing it properly. I had a full camera crew, a creative director, a speechwriter, a personal trainer, a small Mexican to carry my bags and manage my vast wardrobe. We were prepared for anything. Now, at first, the protests were a little disappointing, but then again, we were traveling across the South, which is Milo country. Many was the time in Texas we were stopped by burly aviator-clad bikers or cowboy hat-wearing pickup drivers for autographs, even when I toppled out of the bus into a truck stop wearing a silk robe or a dress. Contrary to the progressive stereotype of bigoted backwater hicks, my audience is far more open-minded than a leftist safe space dweller. When I sold out Louisiana State and tried to troll my own audience by appearing as my drag queen alter ego, Ivana Wall, they gave me a standing ovation. The groundswell of attention that the Rutgers incident brought to my tour forced organizers to move my lectures to bigger venues. The 400-seat venue at Bucknell University filled to capacity in just 15 minutes, and more students were turned away at the door. At Louisiana State, we sold out a 1,200-seater in just 48 hours. Everywhere I go, there are lines around the block. Are these students simply seduced by the controversy and mystery surrounding me and my lectures? Or have I actually kick-started a full-scale revolt, populated by disenfranchised young people who are fed up with political correctness, safe spaces, trigger warnings, and social justice? The leg of the tour offered up magical moments beyond count. At the first new stop in Houston, Texas, an Army Sergeant First Class gifted me his dog tags. This is the closest I've probably ever come to genuinely shedding a tear. The Fort Sam Houston soldier told me, "You give a voice to us who have to be silent, who have to deal with having the political correctness shit pushed down our throats." By the end of the tour, I'd gone all out on theatrics. I submitted myself to a mock college hazing live on stage at Dartmouth. Sometimes, and even I must admit it, audience members stole the show. At the University of South Florida, a girl named Sarah Torrent, who fled a Muslim marriage in her home country, called on leftists and feminists to meet her outside for an ass-kicking if they still insisted on bringing her persecutors into the West. In Clemson, South Carolina, where the school banned references to the deceased gorilla Harambe and the internet meme Pepe the Frog over racism concerns, no really, we discovered a budding James O'Keefe. Conservative student Caleb Ikama spent months infiltrating an anti-Milo group on campus ahead of my visit, mapping out their connections to faculty members, monitoring their attempts to block my visit. I was amazed by the passion and devotion that my tour was inspiring. As Anita the Fag Bus headed up the East Coast, we began to encounter more protests. At West Virginia University, masked anti-fascists, they call themselves that, but they're awfully keen on political violence, they appeared in ski masks carrying placards. One of these said, "Milo sucks." Now, given that the statement was, frankly, perfectly true, I decided that I must own the placard. My cameraman, Matt Purdy, was able to obtain it for me during the grapple going on between protesters, attendees, and campus security in the hallway. During a particularly bitter winter stop at Michigan State University, members of my crew and I thought it would be good fun to don our own ski masks and join the protesters ourselves. It was a daring operation, which we made more exciting by the deliberate misspelling we put on our placards. Would anyone notice? Would our cover be blown? Thankfully, our tactic worked. The placards were so badly spelled that the leftists just assumed we were one of them. The protests on the East Coast were tumultuous, but nothing compared to what lay ahead on West Coast campuses. After their campus cry-ins, leftists move on to throwing tantrums. Extremely destructive tantrums. The first signs of trouble were at UC Davis in January 2017, where I was due to hold a discussion with entrepreneur and Wu-Tang Clan fan Martin Shkreli. The discussion never happened. Protesters rushed the venue around 30 minutes before my event was due to begin, overturning barricades and throwing them at campus police officers. Reports of protesters wielding hammers and smashing windows to gain access to the venue quickly spread. Meanwhile, outside the venue, an ABC 10 reporter was attacked with hot coffee, while my own cameraman, Matt Purdy, was shoved and spat on. It was pandemonium. Within minutes of the barricades being overturned, campus officials were on the phone to my team and the college Republicans, urging them to cancel the event. The Republican group later said they were intimidated by the UC Davis administration, who they said told them that they would be held personally liable for property damage and injury to people, even death. One of the things that's not in the book, but that I can tell you now, is that my tour manager was in the room when the UC Davis administration were outright blatantly lying with the help of their own police force, lying to the college Republicans, telling the college Republicans that people had weaponry and that windows had been smashed when neither of those things were true, to intimidate the college Republicans into cancelling the event. What they were basically saying was, the building's getting smashed up, people are about to be hurt, and if either of those two things happen, you guys are going to be personally liable because the insurance doesn't cover it. This is a lie upon lie upon untruth, and UC Davis was doing this as a way of evading its First Amendment responsibilities. This was the first time I really realized that colleges would do absolutely anything, including subverting the law, just to avoid a conservative voice on campus. I was determined not to let UC Davis's cowardly response, their intimidation of the college Republicans, and the thuggery of left-wing protesters result in a victory for censorship. So the next morning, I led a protest march across campus in defense of free speech. The protesters returned, but they didn't dare attack anyone in broad daylight, and I even took a few selfies with them, although they weren't delighted about it. All was as it should be. Violence and intimidation had not won the day. But the tumult at UC Davis was just a warning. It was a sign of the far greater violence and destruction that was to come. done. The far left had responded to Donald Trump's victory with panic and fury, making dangerous analogies to 1930s fascism, Nazi Germany, and something called the Resistance. A host of militant grassroots organizations sprang up, with threatening names like Disrupt J20. James O'Keefe, a legendary conservative journalist who specializes in infiltration and exposure, caught activists on tape threatening to fight the police and burn houses a few days before inauguration. Inauguration day saw protesters in DC torching trash cans, engaging in running battles with the police, and burning a limousine. Ironically, that limousine, if you didn't hear it on the news, belonged to a chauffeur service owned by a Muslim immigrant. Elsewhere in the city, white nationalist leader Richard Spencer took a punch to the face while he was giving an interview, to the joy of left-wing commentators who quickly set about turning "punch a Nazi" into a meme. "Do punch Nazis," wrote a column for The Observer, who argued that the violent nature of white supremacy made the punch an act of self-defense. Well, you see, the problem with this is the left is perfectly happy telling you that it's okay punching Nazis, but then they define all of the right, anyone to the right of Jane Fonda, as a Nazi. This is one of the things the media does to legitimize violence against conservatives. This is one of the reasons that Breitbart editors and I don't give interviews to places like the New York Times. It's our view that the New York Times is contributing to an atmosphere in which it is acceptable to physically assault conservatives. And until they get their house in order and stop putting our colleagues and our employees at risk, there's no reason why we should waste our time on them. Interestingly, Richard Spencer rejected political violence in the very interview during which he was punched, proof that liberal journalists are a step beneath even white nationalists like Spencer in at least one regard. Newsweek reported that many liberals had, through watching the video of the punch, rediscovered the joy in life. The Independent even published a supercut of Nazis being punched in the face, with the Spencer punch featured alongside clips from Indiana Jones and Inglourious Basterds. As I say, punching Nazis sounds almost reasonable. Well, only almost, until you realize that the left thinks we're all Nazis, we're all racists, and we're all fascists, or some combination of the three. And if that sounds like an exaggeration, remember what prompted their violence. The election and inauguration of Donald Trump, a social liberal from New York who took Ted Cruz to task because the Texas senator was opposed to Caitlyn Jenner using women's bathrooms. I also face the same ludicrous allegation that I'm some kind of jackbooted white supremacist. If this is what counts as a Nazi in 2017, we are all going to get punched, and the act of listening to this book is enough to label you permanently untouchable. Extreme political violence from the left became more and more apparent as I travelled up and down the West Coast, where temper tantrums and physical attacks began to escalate. When I arrived at the University of Washington in Seattle, on Inauguration Day I was greeted in the city by a banner that urged onlookers to stab Milo. University officials took it down that night, but it was a portent of the violence that would take place later in the evening. I was, after all, in the city that hosted the Battle in Seattle, an outbreak of left-wing violence in 1999, in which 40,000 protesters and more than 200 black bloc thugs caused massive damage. Ironically, the 1999 rioters were there to protest globalism, the very ideology Donald Trump is busily fighting in Washington, D.C. today. Rehearsals for my Seattle show had barely begun before a huge mass of protesters arrived on campus. They were throwing buckets of paint and burning things in front of rows of riot police. The police helicopters buzzing in the sky, which was a first for me, testified to the seriousness of the situation. Outside the venue, my cameraman Purdy was assaulted yet again, taking a punch to the face and having his equipment broken. Soon we heard an even more sinister report from outside the venue. Someone had been shot. I was in the middle of my talk and decided to carry on with it, refusing to be cancelled by violence. After the show, police evacuated attendees through an underground car park, telling them to remove their Make America Great Again hats. By now, the anti-Milo protesters had been joined by anti-inauguration protesters from elsewhere in the city, and the crowd swelled to over 1,000. As the critically injured man was rushed to hospital, reports emerged that the police had confiscated wooden poles, heavy pipes, and other weaponry from the black-clad left-wing protesters. The precise circumstances of the shooting were and remain murky, but it was clear that things were getting out of hand. I continued to preach more speech as the only appropriate response to ideological disagreement. The final stop on the Dangerous Faggot Tour was UC Berkeley, perhaps the most famous left-wing college in America. In the 1960s, Berkeley was host to Mario Savio's free speech movement. which fought against the administration's restrictions on political activities on campus. Savio was an ardent left-winger, yet he operated at a time when the left fought against censorship rather than in favour of it. A shy, chronic stutterer, Savio understood the importance of speech. It was no accident that he founded a movement that stressed the value of free speech as inherent to human dignity. I wrote earlier in this book that conservatism is the new counterculture. The inversion of beliefs that's taken place on American college campuses makes my point for me. Once again, Berkeley would be the site of free speech protests, only this time it was the protesters calling for censorship. As at UC Davis, protesters showed up around 30 minutes before I was due to speak. As at the University of Washington, they were well organized, obviously privately funded, armed, clad in black masks, and determined to cause mayhem. They seized barricades and used them as battering rams to smash the windows of the Martin Luther King Student Union, showing ironic contempt and disrespect for King's revered teachings on civil disobedience. These were not sporadic, disorganized outbreaks of violence. The black-masked protesters arrived in a single group and attacked as a single group, storming the building as a unit before melting back into the crowd of supposedly peaceful protesters who happily concealed them. Attendees of the event caught outside were treated mercilessly. One man appeared on camera with a bloody face. A girl wearing a Make Bitcoin Great Again hat was pepper sprayed in the middle of her interview with a local news channel. Later in the evening, video footage emerged of a man lying unconscious on the ground while protesters surrounded him. The rioters, let's dispense with the word protesters, were not satisfied with the cancellation of my event. After word spread that my speech would not happen, the thugs marched into the town of Berkeley itself, where they proceeded to vandalize businesses, including four local banks and, irony level 1,000, a Starbucks. The final estimated crowd size was 1,500, and the total damage was estimated at $100,000 on campus and $500,000 in Berkeley itself. The response of city and campus officials was depressingly predictable. The police did not lift a finger to stop the ongoing riot. They didn't even form a shield wall as they had done at previous universities. John Backett, a lawyer for the union representing the UC system's police force, later complained that frontline police officers weren't allowed to do their jobs. UC Berkeley's attitude amounts to this, wrote the San Francisco Chronicle. We'd rather deal with broken windows than broken heads. The article recalled the lawsuit that had emerged from the Occupy protest at UC Davis in 2011, during which the University of California had to pay out $1 million in a legal settlement after a university police officer pepper sprayed a passive protester. The fires and smashed windows, by contrast, cost UC Berkeley around $100,000. It's not hard to do the math, although it remains unclear who issued the order for the police to stand down. It certainly wasn't me. The mayor of Berkeley was similarly feeble in his response. He started the evening by condemning me, tweeting in typical social justice cliche that using speech to silence marginalized communities and promote bigotry is unacceptable, and that hate speech isn't welcome in our community. The idea that speech can somehow silence others is an insidious progressive meme used to justify censorship. As violence broke out, the mayor, Jesse Aragwin, returned to Twitter to half-heartedly proclaim, "Violence and destruction is not the answer," after he himself had stoked it in the first place. The following morning, he put out a statement condemning the violence, while also calling me a white nationalist. My lawyers forced him to retract and apologize, and it turns out he's Facebook friends with Yvette Falarca, that wonderful little Asian teacher who's the face of the resistance movement by any means necessary, and who so memorably appeared on Tucker Carlson's show shortly afterwards, utterly defiant about her use of violence to shut down speech. Leftist attempts to shut me down backfired. President Trump himself intervened, tweeting that if UC Berkeley could not defend free speech, he might consider withdrawing federal funding. I was invited on the Today Show and Tucker Carlson Tonight. I went with Tucker, obviously, and my media profile soared. Once again, the left had tried to strike me down, and once again, they had made me more powerful and more fabulous than they could possibly have imagined. But that does not mean that we should celebrate the left's dark turn. Under the banner of anti-fascism, the left is bringing the actual tactics of fascists, which is to say, armed political violence, to America's streets. Some on the left have realized just how much this hurts their cause, which is why former Labour Secretary and current Berkeley professor Robert Reich pushed the ludicrous conspiracy theory that the Berkeley riots were part of a plot by Steve Bannon, Breitbart and me to discredit the left, as if we needed to, with BAMN's Yvette Falarca Boasting to the media about the riot's stunning success in shutting me down, this was a difficult argument to maintain, and even the Washington Post scorned his crackpot conspiracy theory. It was bad enough when the radical left was clowning itself by running to safe spaces and therapy sessions whenever a conservative speaker had arrived on campus. But now it is shocking America in another way, by bringing armed political fuggery to the nation's streets in response to respectable, mainstream conservative and libertarian opinion. My visit to Berkeley sent a clear signal to conservatives, libertarians, and other free speech defenders. It was in this California college town where the left's rabid, violent contempt for freedom of thought and expression was finally, brutally exposed. At the time of this writing, I'm planning a week-long rally at Berkeley. Me, Ann Coulter, and other heroes of the right will be in attendance, defending free speech. I'll also be handing out the first ever Mario Savio Award in honor of Berkeley's famous free speech defender. For free speech to have any true meaning, it must be practiced where it is most unwanted. One day, perhaps, the left will realize that the only way to claw back credibility is to meet their opponents with calm, reasoned debate. But if Berkeley, Seattle, and UC Davis are any guide, that is many, many generations away. Despite the hell-raising, my campus tour was about more than just causing a ruckus. There was method to my madness. You see, for too long, the American campus has been the preserve of leftists who channel funding into crackpot gender studies courses and who radicalize students against political tolerance, openness to opposing ideas, and ultimately, against reason itself. For too long, they've gone unchallenged. So how do we fight back against an American education system that provides coloring books, cookies, and emotional support puppies to students who can't handle classy, unthreatening feminism like that of Christina Hoff Sommers? Three things separate my brand of conservatism from the tired suit-and-tie conservatives American college students are so familiar with. Humor, mischief, and sex appeal. Conservatives typically don't have fun. When I think of an American conservative, I think of stuffy bores like Ted Cruz, who, while unarguably brilliant, puts me to sleep. I've injected these three things into right-wing politics, and thus during my tour, I've developed a new and growing coalition of young conservatives and libertarians. The Dangerous Faggot Tour made great strides in the battle being waged on American college campuses. Despite the setbacks and punishments laid out by regressive administrators, we earned several significant victories. After my visit to Rutgers, University President Robert Barkey released a statement in which he reaffirmed the institution's commitment to free speech and academic freedom. He said, quote, "Both academic freedom and our First Amendment rights are at the core of what we do. Our university policy on speech is clear. All members of our community enjoy the rights of free expression guaranteed by the First Amendment. Faculty members, as private citizens, enjoy the same freedoms of speech and expression as any private citizen and shall be free from institutional discipline in the exercise of these rights. In addition, they also enjoy academic freedom of expression when functioning in their roles as faculty members. While I will not defend the content of every opinion expressed by every member of our academic community, or of speakers who we invite to our campus, I will defend their right to speak freely. That freedom is fundamental to our university, our society, and our nation." End quote. At Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, students protested and rallied outside the office of the president after campus sidewalks were chalked with pro-Trump sentiments. The special snowflakes at Emory told reporters they felt threatened by the pro-Trump students, and the campus was no longer a safe place for them. I knew immediately that I had to make a trip to Atlanta, and when I finally made it to Emory, there was anxiety from students concerned over my impending arrival. Although they spent time preparing signs and chants, their protest efforts were largely ignored. The event in the end was so well attended that students filled the hall around the venue, listening to the event and hoping to get a chance to peek in. At the end of my lecture, I led Emory students out onto a center quad and encouraged them all to express themselves on the sidewalk. With students surrounding me, I took a piece of chalk myself and wrote "Dangerous Faggot" in the middle of the quad. And after I finished, I took a bucket of chalk and passed it around to the students in attendance. Students wrote everything from "Fuck Milo" to "Build the Wall." It was a glorious example of what an American university should be. And guess what? Shortly after my visit, Emory's president, James Wagner, took a piece of chalk himself to the sidewalk right next to where I had laid down my own message and wrote in big letters, "Emory stands for free expression." It turns out Wagner attended Emory for his undergraduate studies. He said, "It was always a great, friendly, challenging discussion that really taught you to critically think." He said that, noting these discussions had helped to hone his own political opinions and prepare him for his career as an attorney. He continued, quote, I took that with me to law school, where I was challenged more on my viewpoints. It's really important to understand the opposing side and their arguments, where they're coming from, and to form your own opinions. It's formative, and it's absolutely required, in my opinion, at the university level, end quote. So there you have it. With a few pieces of chalk, what started off as a light-hearted prank to trigger leftists on campus gradually morphed into a symbol of political free speech. We started off by having fun, but we ended up winning a major ideological victory. And that's the beauty of being a happy warrior. You achieve victories without even realizing that you've been fighting. We are winning. The University of Chicago, for instance, is distinguishing itself as a home of free expression, with feisty professors like medievalist Rachel Fulton Brown, who writes the popular blog Fencing Bear. When colleges start to take intellectual and political diversity as seriously as they take the more superficial forms of diversity, then there will no longer be a need for Milo, but there's some time before that happens. In America and beyond, for now, I will continue to fight for my vision of campus life, one of constant intellectual and political stimulation, where dangerous ideas are welcomed rather than shunned, where violating some great taboo will lead to spirited debate, not a trip to the office of an Orwellian biased task force. I will fight for the sound of laughter in the hallways and gasping in the quads. Colleges should be aware that there's a price for quashing free speech and caving into the radical, hateful activists of the regressive left. If you let things get as bad as Berkeley, you might see your campus set on fire, be denounced by the president, and have to cooperate with an FBI investigation. You might see a Milo bill show up in your state legislature. In some cases, the government won't even need to get involved. Just look at the University of Missouri, which became the poster child for left-wing radicalism in 2015, after activists forced the resignation of the college president and demanded the administration submit all students in all departments to a racial awareness and inclusion curriculum, created and overseen by a board composed of students, staff, and faculty of color. In the wake of protests and the university's decision to cave into them, Missouri suffered a massive shortfall in enrollments and alumni donations. Its lack of enrollments forced it to shut two entire residence halls, which were, ironically enough, called Respect and Excellence. The lesson here? Stand up to political bullies or lose both respect and excellence. There are already signs that UC Berkeley might become afflicted by the Missouri disease. Soon after the riots on campus and the woeful response from campus police, Scott Adams, the creator of the syndicated comic strip Dilbert, himself a Berkeley alumnus, announced that he would no longer donate to the college. Here's another lesson colleges need to learn. If you lose your balls, your money will follow. During my college tour, I learned that not all millennial students are pampered, sheltered snowflakes. There are thousands upon thousands of students up and down the country ready to fight back against the intellectually stifling environment that surrounds them. Students who are no longer willing to sit back and be bullied by administrators, faculty members, and leftist activists who want to shut their views down. We can't assume that the entire millennial generation is made up of snowflakes. Remember, some of the social justice left's greatest foes are millennials themselves. Just look at Lauren Southern. She was still a college student when she almost single-handedly destroyed the feminist slutwalk movement with a series of viral counter-protests. Not satisfied, she went on to cause the resignations of a number of social justice warriors in the Libertarian Party of Canada, stalling its descent into hand-wringing leftism. Now she's a rising star of the right, producing powerful journalism on the Islamic takeover of Europe. If the millennial generation can produce women like Southern, it's hardly fair to call them all snowflakes. Perhaps millennials are thin-skinned because the culture they grew up with was so soft around the edges. I was in the last few years of teens who grew up with Marilyn Manson, Guns N' Roses, Nine Inch Nails, Madonna, The Dark Crystal, Time Bandits, and The Neverending Story. If you're listening to this and you're 22 or 23, by comparison, your culture has been remarkably fluffy and peril-free. When I was growing up, not every story had a happy ending, and it wasn't always obvious who the bad guys were. I idolized Mariah Carey and Paris Hilton, but also Skeletor, Darth Vader, and Margaret Thatcher. My generation, and all generations before me, were exposed at a young age to the reality that life can be cruel, and being a good person isn't going to change that. Your generation? Not so much. Partly because you grew up on Justin Bieber instead of Rage Against the Machine, but also because your teachers and professors have insulated you from any and all forms of trauma. Professors who want to follow the example of the University of Chicago should suffer in silence no longer. Now is the perfect time to start a resistance movement. There will be pushbacks and reprisals in the beginning, but in the long run it will pay off. The defenders of the status quo are too few and too unpopular to cling on to power forever. Dissident faculty members, listen up. I've given you an army. Use it. There's no better time to achieve a revolution on college campuses than now. Potential allies are multiplying. Everywhere you look, there are moderate liberals conceding defeat to conservatives and admitting that political correctness has gone too far, admitting that their own side has gone crazy. A new coalition is waiting to be built. Fighting the good fight can be tiring, but it's not all bad. I've become ever more notorious, and I was the most disinvited campus speaker of 2016. But this is just a bonus, because what I've done is brew a revolution on college campuses, and my tour is an important component of that. We spent just $2 million. Compare that with the hundreds of millions that are poured into conservative think tanks. Just $2 million. And we forced colossal change in American higher education, achieving more in my year on the road than two generations of conservatives before me. And we're just getting started. My next tour, which will be underway by the time you listen to this, is called Troll Academy. Every time they try to ban me, I get more powerful because I don't back down. You could say I'm only theatrical because they force me to be. Would there be a market for Milo if conservative and libertarian opinions were treated just as fairly as everyone else's? If Batman is the yin to the Joker's yang, perhaps Milo has to exist to balance out Lena Dunham. Well, you'll know I've won when no one comes to my shows anymore. But in the meantime, as everyone knows, there are lines outside the front door everywhere I show.